Good morning, brothers and sisters. You're on Remnant Radio, and the program today at 11 o'clock Las Vegas time is From the Hip. Today we're going to continue a topic that we've been discussing for a couple of weeks, and that is the evidence that there is for the Noah's Flood, the worldwide global deluge catastrophe. We'll be taking calls at the last quarter of the hour, just before 1 o'clock. So at 12:45, we'll begin taking calls. The phone number here at Remnant Radio is 702-293-5224. Feel free to call in at about a quarter till 1 o'clock. That gives us 15 minutes to have discussions about any of the topics today. Last week we went through the geological evidence of the universality of the Genesis flood, and this week we're going to be discussing the biblical evidence of the universality of the Genesis flood. And this particular article is covered by Richard M. Davidson, John Nevin Andrews, professor of Old Testament interpretation, the Old Testament Department of Andrews University, Barron Springs, Michigan. And there is an incredible amount of references, again, that cover the biblical evidence of the universality of Noah's flood, that being it, being proofs that it was a global flood. And we've got, again, probably about, somewhere, just in this one particular article, over 50 different references that that they cite. So we're going to jump right into it. This is very interesting because the evidences biblically of a worldwide flood go on beyond Genesis. It's in the context of the way that it's written, the way that many of the writers of the Bible write. They write in reference to a global flood. And we discussed last week that there are an amazing amount of cultures throughout the world that have a ancient story that is almost exactly the same or similar in many aspects about being, we went over the percentages, how many believe that there was a global flood, and they had stories in their ancient writings about it, and there was a favored family, and it goes on and on. There's a lot to this. So we're going to go into this with this Andrews University professor, John Nevin Andrews. Sounds like he might even be related. So let's take a look. Conflicting schools of interpretation. One of the most controversial aspects of the flood narrative concerns the extent of the Genesis flood. Three major positions are taking. One, the traditional, which asserts the universal worldwide nature of the deluge. Two, limited or local flood theories, which narrow the scope of the flood story to a particular geographical location in Mesopotamia. And three, a non-literal or symbolic interpretation, which suggests that the flood story is a non-historical account written to teach theological truth. So we've got three areas. The traditional, which is the worldwide flood everybody learned about, you know, Noah's Ark and all the animals. The second one is a localized flood theory. The third is that the whole thing was just symbolic. So against this third position, the non-historical, we must note the evidences within the biblical account affirming the historical nature of the flood. In the literary structure of the flood story, the genealogical frame or envelope construction plus the secondary genealogies are indicators that the account is intended to be factual history. So the genealogical record gives the foundation that it's fact. It's not fiction. So from there, we rule out the third, the non-literal, and we're going to be concentrating on the traditional worldwide theology of the global flood or the limited and local flood theory. The use of genealogical term tol dot, or generations, or account, in the flood story, as throughout Genesis 13 times, structuring the whole book, indicates that the author intended this story to be as historically true as the rest of Genesis. Walter Kaiser analyzes the literary form of Genesis 1 through 11 and concludes that this whole section of Genesis must be taken as historical narrative prose. A number of references in the book of Job may allude to the then relatively recent flood, because Job is known as the oldest book in the Bible. The Bible is not actually written according, you know, chronologically. You can get a chronological Bible, though. Job 9, 5 through 8, Job 12, 14 through 15, Job 14, 11 and 12, Job 22, 15 through 17, Job 26, 10 through 14, Job 28, verse 9, Job 38, 8 through 11. Now, these are just in the book of Job itself, the oldest book in the Bible, that gives alludations, or it alludes. This is just the one book. The historical occurrence of the flood is part of the saving and judging acts of God, and its historicity is assumed and essential to the theological arguments of later biblical writers employing flood typology. More on this point later. So you've got other biblical writers much, much later than Job who are writing their books of the Bible, the canonized Protestant Bible, that are utilizing the theology that it was a global flood. So we've got guys in the Bible that we're considering to be God-breathed who are just automatically believers that it was a worldwide deluge. So let's take a look further into this. Thus, according to the biblical writers, far from being a non-historical or symbolical or mythical account written only to teach theological truths, the flood narrative is intended to accurately record a real, literal, historical event. For evangelical Christians who take seriously the biblical record and accept the historicity of the flood account, the question still remains whether the event described is to be taken as a local, limited flood or a universal, worldwide cataclysm. The limited flood theories rest primarily on scientific arguments that present seemingly difficult geological, biological, and anthropological problems for a universal flood. Since the scientific argumentation is not the subject of this article, I can only suggest that these problems are not insurmountable, although much more study is needed. We did discuss that last week. A number of studies provides a growing body of evidence for diluvial catastrophism as an alternative to conventional long-age geology. And that's what we discussed last week again. So we've covered that whole area, but this particular topic, according to this writer, is not about that. It's about the biblical written evidence and the historicity that these biblical writers are giving for the factual account, according to their theology, of the flood. We've got a couple fellas here that are hanging out listening to the radio program. A couple very close friends of ours. They're just laying side by side, purring. They seem to be very very content indeed. No shame at all. The local flood theories further assert that the terminology describing the extent of the flood should be interpreted in a relative and not absolute universal sense. Let's read that again. Okay, these guys have a vocabulary here that can probably get most of us lost. Okay, very, very slowly, let's listen to this. The local flood theories assert further that the terminology describing the extent of the flood should be interpreted in a relative and not absolute universal sense. So the remote flooding or the flooding of localized areas is supposed to be considered in a relative, that the terminology that's used is supposed to be considered relative rather than absolute, meaning, you know, flat out, that's it. So if you look at it in that light, of course you'll be able to come up with a localized theology, if you want to go there. According to this, it's still in the theory stage because of the overwhelming evidence that's against it. So we're going to be talking about that terminology. The various seemingly universal terms are regarded as implying only a limited locality. They are seen to indicate universality within the writer's worldview, but a limited scope in terms of our modern worldview. We'll take up this issue in the next section of this article. The traditional conservative understanding of the flood narrative is that Genesis 6:9 describes a universal worldwide deluge. It should be noted that this is also the view of the majority of liberal critical commentators on Genesis 6:9, although they regard the biblical view as borrowed from the A&E accounts and not historical. There's a ton of sites here that you can check out. Some of these are and other more recent representatives' views cited later. The thesis of this article is that only the traditional position of a literal universal worldwide flood does full justice to the biblical data. And this universal interpretation is crucial for flood theology in Genesis and for the theological implications drawn by later biblical writers. So for the Genesis flood theology, it's critical that it's universal. For later biblical writers and what they write, it's critical that it's universal. And it's the only thing that does full justice to the biblical data. And we're going to be discussing that. Now, the first thing we're going to cover is eight different terms. Eight different terms and how they are actually pro-universal flood. And this is covering all the Bible here. We're getting not just in Genesis, but we're getting into Psalms. We're getting into other New Testament books as well. And then from there, we're going to be discussing 14 points. 14 points of other biblical evidence for the universal flood. So let's discuss the eight terms first of all, and then we'll get into the 14 other points. Okay, so altogether we're looking at 22 different just biblical reasons. We covered geology last week, and I mean there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of evidences of a universal flood in geology. Scientifically, it's impossible to have a localized flood that's above the mountains, and biblically we're talking about the flood must, it's critical that the flood story, the traditional flood story of it being universal worldwide, is critical in order for the rest of the Bible to make sense with these other writers are writing about the universal flood. Okay, so I'm pretty sure I've made that clear. Okay, biblical terminology in Genesis 6:9 indicating universality. Perhaps the most important kind of biblical evidence for a universal flood is the specific, all-inclusive terminology found within the Genesis account itself. The late Gerhard Hassel has provided a careful treatment of this terminology in three penetrating studies in previous issues of Origins. This is a book that this gentleman Hassel has written. 74, 75, and 78. Therefore, I need not go into detail in this article. Eight different terms or phrases in Genesis 6:9, most echoing their counterparts in the worldwide creation account of Genesis 1 and 2, indicate universality. So we've got a comparison between the recreation, essentially, of Earth. I mean, if you consider in the beginning, Genesis 1, you've got an Earth here, and it is just the Spirit of God went back and forth on the face of the deep. Here we have Earth is completely submerged, and it's without form, is saying. And here we have a blob of water. Now, obviously, God is creating land and trees and all this other kind of stuff later. But at this time, on the face of the deep, he's calling it. So the Earth is completely engulfed. Now, one of the major supporting theologies of the way God is, the character of God, you got to remember, he repented. That means turn around and go back. He repented of the fact that he had created mankind. And so he said he's going to wipe them all out and start all over again. Now, what did he do in the beginning? The face of the deep. And so that theology in itself supports the global flood. I mean, you've got all this water. He says he separates the waters from the waters. He holds the waters back from underneath the earth. So there are waters down there that he is actually... Somewhere in the scripture it says he created bars and doors, and he's slamming these waters in there. He's imprisoned these waters. And this is, something that he releases again, and then he releases all the waters from above. And the waters that he separated, I shall divide the waters from the waters in Genesis, creation account, come back together again, and once again you have the earth without form and nothing but the face of the deep. Okay. I mean, otherwise you would think that if he had, you know, the Israelites roaming around in the wilderness for 40 years, and he kicked Adam and Eve out of the garden, you know, he's got all these people roaming here and there, you know, Israel down into Babylon, and taken away here and there, and into captivity into Egypt, and you name it, that he would have just probably over the 100 and some odd years that it took Noah to construct this immense ark, that he would have just had him get out of the region if it was a local flood. Why in the world would God make a man go through all this stuff just so that he could float on top of his particular land? I don't necessarily think that there's a whole lot of evidence in the scripture to support that. You know, if you want to believe in a localized flood, then he would have probably just told him to get out of the area. You know, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. God's pretty practical. You know, why would he have a man spend hundreds of years constructing something like this and take all the animals in it when he could have just shoot everyone, including the animals, out of the area and taken care of the wicked men? It makes absolutely no sense at all. So it's almost hard to believe how anybody can take all this evidence that we're going to get into, not to mention scientific and geological evidence, and come up with a local flood theory. So okay, let's continue where we left off. 8 different terms or phrases in Genesis 6-9, most echoing their counterparts in the worldwide creation account of Genesis 1 and 2. They indicate universality. First, the term Ha'ares, the earth, occurring 46 times in the flood narrative, always without any accompanying genitive or limitation, clearly parallels the usage of the same term in the account of worldwide universal creation in Genesis 1, 1, 2, and 10. While the term at times elsewhere may be used without a genitive and is still in context be limited in scope to a certain land, the explicit link to creation in the flood account, especially Genesis 6, 6, and 7, clearly gives a universal context for its usage in Genesis 6 through 9. Some have argued that if Moses had wished to indicate the entire world, he would have used the Hebrew term tebel, which means the world as a whole, or dry land in the sense of continents. This word is never used in the flood narrative, but it should be pointed out that tebel is never used in the entire Pentateuch, including the creation account. So he's never referring to the entire global earth using this particular term in the entire Pentateuch, in any of the 5 books he's written. But he's always using this other word, Ha'ares, meaning the earth. In fact, the term appears nowhere in the narrative portions of the Hebrew Bible, but only in poetic texts. So in 39 times do you get this in poetic texts. Okay, usually which actually Moses did write some of this poetry, usually as a poetic synonym in parallel with Ha'ares, meaning the earth. Now there are things called Hebrewisms, and these words, it's kind of like when you're translating something from English to Spanish. Let's say you're trying to translate, I saw on television the other day, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. All these kids are singing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Now, they have to actually come up with words that are similar, yet they rhyme in order to make a song. You got to come up with rhyming words, and you still got to get your point across about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So this is kind of like what a Hebrewism is they use words that rhyme, you know, like Adam Adama. You know, that's Adam, the first man. So these kind of languages are called Hebrewisms. So here in poetry, they're using the word Tabel as a poetic synonym in parallel with Haarez, meaning the earth. Thus, this argument from silence does not adequately consider the contextual and poetic use of terminology and carries little weight. Number two, the second term. A second expression upon the face of all the earth. This is al pene kol haarez, as close as my English can get it. Clearly alludes to the first occurrence of the same phrase in the universal context of creation in Genesis 1:29. Genesis 1:2 for a related universal expression. And thus, here also implies a universality of the same dimension, the entire surface of the global mass. While the shortened term all the earth, or kol ha'ares, by itself may have a limited meaning elsewhere when indicated by the immediate contexts. That means, in context, the shortened term kol ha'ares, meaning all the earth, can actually mean, according to the context, the area, like all the earth went into the woods. You know, obviously it means all the land in that place. But being a individual, these Hebrews knew that that their language had the same meaning for a local vicinity versus the entire area. And that would be why they would include additional words to verify precisely what they're talking about. Upon the face of all the earth. You know, we're talking about the face of all the earth versus all the earth or all the land. So they use these additional words, like in the six creation days. After every single day, they say, was it evening and was it morning? This was the day first. Was it evening? Was it morning? This was the day second. And this day, there's a great big article on somebody who's, you know, talking about all the different uses and why it didn't have to be a literal 24-hour day and all the different uses of the word day, but they never discuss in this 17-page article that little segment after every single day where he says, then was a morning, then was an evening, then was a morning, the day one, then was an evening, then was a morning, the day two. There's probably about, you know, less than three lines that simply refer to that. But they completely avert the subject. If you're a Hebrew and you know that you're speaking the word day, and it could mean an era of time, it could mean the length of a man's life, it could mean the day of the Lord, it could mean one specific 24-hour day, you have to specify in Hebrew that you're talking about a 24-hour segment. And in order to do that, when you're using words that mean all the same thing, you got to throw in some additional explanation, which would be, then was evening, then was morning. That indicates a 24-hour segment. So they don't discuss that when they talk about how the great possibility that it's not. You know, they do stretch the Word of God like silly putty, but they really don't just take it at face value, which is obviously what the writer is trying to get across to you. Take it at face value. This was an evening and a morning. This was a day. Okay? They're using that terminology. So let's continue with the article here. Remember, we're using additional Hebrew words in order to explain terms or expressions that could possibly mean something else. This is how they get you to understand what exactly they're talking about. Upon the face of all the earth versus all the earth. Okay, it depends on the context. The immediate context of the flood story is the universal sinfulness of humankind, whom God had made and created to have dominion over, quote, all the earth, Genesis 1:26. And the succeeding context is the universal dispersal of man after the Tower of Babel, upon the face of all the earth. Here we have that al pene kol haaretz, again, Genesis 11:4, 8, and 9. In each of the four occurrences of the phrase upon the face of all the earth, in Genesis, outside the flood story, it clearly has the universal sense of the entire land surface of the globe, and there's nothing in the flood narrative to indicate any less universality. It should be also globe excuse me, it should be also noted that the one place in Genesis where, in context, a similar phrase, upon all the face of the earth, is not universal, is the famine mentioned in Genesis 41. The Hebrew has a change in word order form elsewhere in Genesis. Al kol pene ha'ares versus al pene kol ha'ares. So they swap the words around. Of course, in English, you know, we got to pay attention to this or we're going to get lost. So, okay, the number three, the third term, the phrase face of the ground, pene ha'adama, five times in the flood narrative. This would be chapter 7, verse 4, 22, 23, and chapter 8, verse 8 and 13, occurs in parallel with universal terms we have just noted being the earth, chapter 7, verse 23, and face of all the earth, chapter 8, verse 9. And the phrase face of the ground, pene ha'adama, likewise harks back to its first usage in the universal context of creation in Genesis 2:6. Now, remember, we're still talking about the same guy. This same guy wrote the same book, okay? We're even in the same book here. So obviously he's going to be using the same language, even if it was different from one man to the other. One man's Hebrew is different than another man's Hebrew. You know, I can write something and somebody else can get the same point across using English or American as we speak and have different context. But we're talking about the same man, even in the same book, using the same terms, which would indicate a universal context. Okay. Fourth, the term kol basar, or all flesh, occurs 12 times in Genesis 6:9. The word kol, meaning all, which can occasionally express less than totality if the context demands it. Before an immediate noun with no article or possessive suffix. Okay, we're talking about English here, okay, or Hebrew, if you will. We're talking about the actual construction, sentence construction. Before an intermediate noun, the word kol, with no article or possessive suffix, as here in Genesis 6:9, indicates totality. So you don't have the context that demands that the word all could not necessarily mean everything. You don't have that here. God's announcement to destroy, quote, all flesh, Genesis 6:13 and 17, and the narrator's comment that, quote, all flesh died, in Genesis 7:21 and 22, except the inhabitants of the ark, indicates the universal destruction. The one occurrence of kol plus the determinant noun ha-basar, that would be kol ha-basar, all the flesh, in Genesis 7:15, likewise indicates totality as well as unity. So the only difference between the times that he uses kol, kol ha-basar, or all the flesh, or all versus all flesh, he's basically, it's a double indication that it's not only total, but it's also unity to the rest of everything. So the only difference is actually better than the original. Fifth, number five, the expression, every living thing, kol ha-he, of all flesh, is another expression of totality. In chapter 7, verse 4 and 23, the similar term, kol ha-ikum, means literally all existence. This term is given further universal dimensions by the addition of the clause harking back to creation. All existence that I have made, chapter 7, verse 4, and by the exclusive statement, quote, only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. So you've got, you know, number 5 is, that's pretty strong. Pretty strong. So let's take a look at what this man here, Hassel, has to say about it. There is hardly any stronger way in Hebrew to emphasize total destruction of all existence of human and animal life on earth than the way it has been expressed. So, I mean, even the Hebrews itself, even the writer here himself couldn't possibly write it better to explain that it was a universal flood. The writer of the Genesis flood story employed, look at all these things he employed, terminology, formula, and syntactical structures of the type that could not be more emphatic and explicit in expressing his concept of a universal worldwide flood. So this is why all the rest of the writers of the scriptures and history supports this, because all these people who wrote in the Bible are all Hebrews. You know, you've got all these people here who are not necessarily Hebrews, but they're all from the descendants of Noah, before Abraham, after, etc. But basically, you're looking at everybody, all God's chosen people here, all speaking the original language of Hebrew, I should probably say, and they're all agreeing in their syntactical ways, structures, their formula, their terminologies, that this was a global, worldwide flood, because they understand Hebrew. You know, they recognize that the man's terminology, the man's formula, and the man's syntactical structures are telling them this was a worldwide thing. And the man that I know who speaks Hebrew also read the account and said it was very clear. Let's continue. We're at 5 of 8. Number 6. 6, the phrase, quote, under the whole heaven, tahat kol ha'amayim, is used 6 times in the Old Testament outside of the flood narrative, and always with the universal meaning. Deuteronomy 2:25, 4:19, Job 28:24, chapter 37:3, chapter 41:11, and Daniel 9:12. So the phrase under the whole heaven is always used outside of the flood narrative in the Old Testament as a universal meaning. For example, the phrase is used to describe God's omniscience, quote, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees under the whole heavens. This is Job 28, verse 24. Again, it depicts God's sovereignty, quote, whatsoever is under the whole heaven is mine. Job 41, verse 11. Note that the usage in Deuteronomy 2, verse 25, describing, quote, the nations under the whole heaven is further qualified and limited by the phrase, quote, who shall hear the report of you, and thus is potentially universal and not an exception to the universal sense. The universal phrase under the whole heaven, or under all the heavens, also universalizes the phrase under heaven in Genesis 6, verse 17. In this same flood context, the word heaven alone can have a local meaning, like in 1 Kings 18, verse 45, but here the context is clearly universal. Ecclesiastes, which contains numerous allusions to creation, that's allusions, not illusions, okay, allusions, meaning alluding to, okay, likewise utilizes the term, quote, under heaven, which with a universal intention. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 13, chapter 2, verse 3, chapter 3, verse 1. The parallel universal expression under the sun in Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 3 and 9, chapter 2, verse 11 and 17. In the flood account, this phrase, under the whole heaven, is part of 2 forceful verses describing the extent of the flood. And the waters prevailed so mightily, this is a quote, and the waters prevailed so mightily upon the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. Here we have a double indication. Again, the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. This is chapter 7, verse 19 and 20. Critical scholar John Skinner notes that chapter 7, verse 19 and 20 not only asserts its universality, the flood's universality, but so to speak proves it by giving the exact height of the waters above the highest mountains. The biblical language here simply cannot be explained in terms of a local sky, and certainly cannot refer to the local mountains being covered by snow, as some proponents of a local flood suggest. H.C. Leupold, points out that the writer of verse 19 is not content with a single use of kol being all in, quote, all the high mountains. But since all is known to be used in a relative sense, remember the Hebrews recognize that all can be used in a relative sense, the writer removes all possible ambiguity, meaning a double meaning, by adding the phrase under all the heavens. A double all cannot allow for so relative a sense. So he undoes the possibility of anybody believing that was anything besides everything. Okay? It almost constitutes a Hebrew superlative. So we believe that the text disposes of the question of the universality of the flood. Number seven, the seventh term, Hassel, devoted an entire scholarly article to the phrase of, quote, all the fountains, ma yenoth. This is Hebrew, ma yenoth, meaning all the fountains of the deep, tehom, or world ocean, in Genesis 1, verse 2. Psalms 104, verse 6, thou didst cover it, meaning the earth, with deep, tehom, as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. The, quote, breaking up and, quote, bursting forth, or geological faulting, of not just one subterranean water spring in Mesopotamia, but of all the fountains of the deep. We're using the word all, coupled in the same verse with the opening of the windows of the heavens, far transcends a local scene. So the writer, even in Psalms, is talking about all, you broke up all the fountains of the deep. So this certainly would cover more than just one little itty-bitty area of the globe. Hassel perceptively concludes that the bursting forth of the waters from the fountains of the, quote, great deep refers to the splitting open of springs of subterranean waters with such might and force that together with the torrential downpouring of waters stored in the atmospheric heavens, a worldwide flood comes about. Number eight. In another article, this gentleman Hassel in 1978 shows how the Hebrew Bible reserved a special term, Mabul, which in its 13 occurrences refers exclusively to the universal Genesis flood. 12 occurrences in Genesis, once in Psalm 29, verse 10. This word may be derived from the Hebrew root YBL, Yebel, to flow, to stream. The term Mabul, which in the flood narrative is usually associated with Mayim, or the waters, seems to have become a technical term for waters flowing or streaming forth, and as such designates the flood or the deluge being caused by waters. Mabul is in the Old Testament a term consistently employed for the flood or the deluge, which was caused by torrential rains and the bursting forth of subterranean waters. This technical term clearly sets the Genesis deluge apart from all local floods and is utilized in the Psalm 29, verse 10, to illustrate Yahweh's universal sovereignty over the world at the time of the Noahic flood. That's Noah's flood. The Lord, this is a quote, the Lord sat enthroned at the flood, and the Lord sits as king forever. Summarizing regarding the technical terminology used for the extent of the flood in Genesis 6:9, Hassel writes again, the Genesis flood narrative provides ample evidence of being an account which is to be understood as a historical narrative in prose style. It expects to be taken literally. There is a consistent and overwhelming amount of terminological and formula. Okay, terminology and formula, which on the basis of context and syntax has uniformly indicated that the flood story wants to be understood in a universal sense. The waters destroyed all human and animal plus bird life on the entire landmass of the globe. To read it otherwise means to force a meaning on the carefully written and specific syntactical constructions of the original language, which the text itself rejects. So, forcing a meaning on the syntactical construction of the original language and carefully written, which the language itself rejects the meaning of a, you know, you'd have to force on it to be a local flood. So, it's written the way it's written to let everybody know that it was universal and have no doubt. And it's completely referred to again and again in a universal sense in the Bible. Other biblical evidence for a universal flood. Now, we just covered the eight terms, terminology found within the Bible. And these are all Hebrew words in the proper syntax and context with the terminology and the formula that would indicate in eight different terms located, I can't remember how many times each one of these terms is located in the scriptures, but eight of these Hebrew terms are located that prove that it was a universal flood. And everybody who was Hebrew or wrote in the Bible, you know, pre-Abraham understood it that way. These are people who spoke the language. These are people who know that in order to let your point come across perfectly clear, you sometimes have to add some language, some Hebrew language there, so that everybody knows exactly what you're talking about. Very interesting. We've only covered eight terms, and we still have 14 other points that are biblical evidence for a universal flood. So let's begin these, and we'll take a break in about 15 minutes, listen to a little bit of music, and we'll start these. Other biblical evidence for a universal flood. Many additional lines of biblical evidence converge in affirming the universal extent of the flood, and also reveal the theological significance of this conclusion. We will summarize 14 points that emerge from the biblical text. First, the trajectory of major themes in Genesis 1 through 11, creation, fall, plan of redemption, spread of sin, is universal in scope and calls for a corresponding universal judgment. We've already noted, in reference to specific flood terminology, the numerous allusions. Remember, this is not illusions, this is allusions, meaning alluding to the numerous allusions to the universal context of creation. The creation of, quote, the heavens and the earth certainly is not local in scope, according to Genesis 1 through 2. Likewise, the fall of humanity in Adam and Eve led to the sinful condition of the entire human race, Ha-Adam. Ha-Adam, not just the inhabitants of Mesopotamia. Again, the Proto-Evangelium, the first gospel promise outlined in Genesis 3:15, involves the universal moral struggle between the spiritual descendants or seed of the serpent and the spiritual descendants or seed of the woman, culminating in the victory of the representative messianic seed over the serpent. This plan of redemption is certainly universal in scope. In a similar way, the sinful condition of humankind described at the time of the flood includes more than those living in the Fertile Crescent. From God's perspective, not simply from the culturally conditioned local view of the narrator, we have the results of the divine investigative judgment. Quote, and God saw that the wickedness of man, Hadam, or humankind, was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Genesis 6, verse 5. Such universal sinfulness naturally calls for universal judgment. Second, the divine purpose given for the bringing of the flood makes explicit its universal scope. And the Lord said, quote, I will destroy man, Hadam, that being humanity, whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. Genesis 6, verse 7. Nothing less than a complete destruction of the human race, except for Noah, chapter 6, verse 8, seems envisaged, meaning envisioned. Given the length of time from creation, over 1,650 years minimum, the longevity of the antediluvians, nearly 1,000 years, meaning the lifespan of the people before the deluge, and God's command at creation to, quote, fill the earth, in Genesis 1, verse 28, it is highly unlikely that the pre-flood population would have stayed only in Mesopotamia. Thus, the destruction of humanity would necessitate more than a local flood. Point number three. Third, the genealogical lines from both Adam and Noah are exclusive in nature, indicating that as Adam was father of all pre-flood humanity, so Noah was father of all post-flood humanity. From the descendants of Noah, the nations, this is a quote, the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. Now, they're not talking about the 12 tribes here, okay? There are no 12 tribes. So the word nations, which is used here, are all of the nations of the earth, because we're talking about Noah. From the descendants of Noah, the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. And the Tower of Babel experience spreads humanity across the globe. Striking extra-biblical evidence that all human races, and not just the nations of the Fertile Crescent, are included in the descendants of Noah and retain memory of the universal flood, is found in the amazing prevalence of ancient flood stories throughout the world. We discussed this previously. This is extra-biblical. This is beyond the Bible evidence that all human races, not just the nations of the Fertile Crescent in Mesopotamia, are included in the descendants of Noah. Because they have all these ancient flood stories, every one of these things. Over 230 different flood stories are known and occur among the most diverse peoples of the earth. 230 nations we're talking about, okay? Wow. A worldwide flood is by far the most frequently given cause for past universally destructive calamities in the folk literature of antiquity. I mean, ancient folk literature, you got the flood all over the place. A remarkable number of these oral and written traditions agree upon the basic points of the biblical account. All humankind was destroyed by a great flood as a result of divine judgment against human sin. And a single man and his family, or a few friends, survived the deluge in a ship or other seafaring vessel. The stories nearest to the area of the dispersion at Babel are the closest in detail to the biblical account. This vast body of ancient witnesses to a worldwide deluge is powerful testimony to the historicity and universality of the biblical flood. Fourth, point number four. Let's take a look at what time we got. Let's go ahead and take a break. We're going to stop at point number four, and I'm going to come down here, and we're going to find some music for us to... Let's go with... What do we have here? Oh, we got Good News Blues all over the place. Okay, let's go with this here. Okay. Why? How come we're not playing over here? But I got to double click on that. Okay. Double click.
Trouble comes to you, the devil tempt you to discount it all joy and endure patiently. If you resist the devil's got to flee. Yeah, the devil got to flee. Because there ain't no message without the mess. There ain't no testimony without the test. Into every life, the storm's gonna come. I'll build your house on the rock. Christ Jesus, God's Son. The Christ Jesus, God's Son. Without the mess, there ain't no testimony. Without the test, into every life, the storm's gonna come. I'll build your house on the rock. The Christ of Jesus, God's Son. The Christ Jesus, God's Son. And trust in His Word, every promise is true. What He's done for others, He'll do for you. Stand on His Word, having done all, stand. And He'll lead you out with a strong right hand. With a strong right hand. Because there ain't no message without the mess. There ain't no testimony without the test. Into every life, the storm's gonna come. I'll build your house on the rock. Christ of Jesus, God's Son. The Christ Jesus, God's Son. Because there ain't no message without the mess. There ain't no testimony without the test. Into every life, the storm's gonna come. I'll build your house on the rock. Christ of Jesus, God's Son. Jesus, God's Son.
All right, brothers and sisters, we're back, and you're listening to Remnant Radio. The program is called From the Hip. I'm JT, and you can call the station at a quarter till one. We're going to go ahead and receive calls at the last quarter hour of the show, and the phone number here is 702-293-5224. If you're new and you're just coming on, we're discussing the biblical evidences of the global cataclysmic flood, and we've just discussed eight different terms that the Bible has used throughout the Bible, not just in the Genesis account. And we have gotten into point number four of an additional 14 points that the Bible gives that the flood was in fact universal, global. And we've discussed that the Hebrew language proves it. The writers of the rest of the Bible understood the language better than the rest of us, and they understood very clearly that it was a global flood, and they referred to it in a global fashion throughout their writings, if they referred to it. Well, now let's take a look at point number four in the 14 additional points of the Bible. Fourth, the same inclusive divine blessing to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth is given to both Adam and Noah. Genesis 1, verse 28, and chapter 9, verse 1. This is another linkage between universal creation and the flood, between the original beginning and the new beginning. As the human race at creation flows from Adam and Eve, so the post-diluvial, or after the flood, humanity is populated through Noah. Fifth, the covenant, Genesis chapter 9, verses 9 through 10, with its rainbow sign in Genesis 9, verse 12 through 17, is clearly linked to the extent of the flood and includes the whole earth. Now, this is the rainbow, and it is linked to the extent, meaning the whole earth. if there was only a local flood, then the covenant would be only a limited covenant. And the rainbow, sign of the all-embracing universality of the divine mercy, would be stripped of its meaning. Sixth, the viability of God's promise in Genesis chapter 9, verse 15, and also in Isaiah 54, 9, and the integrity of God in keeping His promise is wrapped up in the worldwide extent of the flood. This point cannot be underscored too heavily. In Genesis 6 through 9, if Genesis 6 through 9 describes only a local flood, then God has broken His promise every time another local flood has happened. The only way God's promise not to send another flood to destroy every living thing, as is written in Genesis chapter 8, verse 21, can be seen to have been kept if the flood was a universal one and the whole human race outside the ark was destroyed. This is a very good point. The viability of God's promise, saying that, if it was a local flood and He promised not to wipe out mankind again, then every time we have a local flood or the tsunami and it wipes out mankind of a certain area, He's broken His promise. And we know that we have the only way that He could have kept that promise is if He was referring in a universal context. Seventh, the universality of the flood is underscored by the enormous size of the ark detailed in Genesis 6, 14 through 15, and the stated necessity for saving all the kinds of animals and plants in the ark. A massive ark filled with representatives of all non-aquatic animal and plant kinds would be unnecessary if this were only a local flood. For these kinds could have been preserved elsewhere in the world. Why would He drag one of every kind into the ark when, if it was only a local thing, they would have been preserved throughout the world? Yet, the divine insistence in the biblical record is that the animals were brought into the ark to preserve representatives of all of the various kinds. Genesis chapter 6, verse 19 through 20. As a matter of fact, if only a local flood were in view, the building of any ark at all, even for Noah and his family, would have been superfluous. Would have been a big waste of time. God could simply have warned Noah and his family in time to escape from the coming judgment, just as He did with Lot in Sodom. But the point of the narrative concerning the ark is that there was no other escape in the midst of the flood. Quote, only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained. So that's really obvious. I mean, we serve a God. I don't want to sound blasphemous to anybody, but He's a very practical man. Okay, He's a very practical guy. We're created in His image, so we need to understand that God is not entirely outside the scope of human reason. Okay, we can't put God in a place. Now I know that His ways are unsearchable. But that doesn't mean that, we have to start twisting stuff up here in order to meet our own theological rhetoric. The fact is God uses very practical means that we can understand, if we look in the Spirit at these things. If we're created in God's image, what makes you think that our, capacities and our functions, especially after the fact that we've eaten from the tree, and He says, behold, man has become as we are, okay? What makes you think that He doesn't do stuff that we can understand? If we look at it, and if we examine it, and if we study it hard enough, all kinds of things, and He tells us to do that, all kinds of things that He does become clear to us once we recognize the correlation. So, he's not entirely out there, folks. He's not gonna trick us, the whole way, sorry, you didn't get the crossword puzzle right, therefore you're going to burn in hell, This is not the plan. He's got a divine plan. Everything, went wrong, and he made a yin and yang type of thing, a positive and negative type of thing set up in the beginning so that everything can be flip-flopped, and all those who are obedient are going to take over everybody who is disobedient. It's really simple, you know. And the Bible even refers to the people in the days of Noah that Christ preached to, the prisoners, you know, those in the days of Noah. I can't remember exactly which prophetic book it was, but I will probably refer to that a little later. Eighth, the covering of all the high mountains by at least 15 cubits in Genesis chapter 7, verse 19 through 20, could not involve simply local flood, since water seeks its own level across the surface of the globe. Even one high mountain covered in a local Mesopotamian setting would require that same height of water everywhere on the planet's surface. In this connection, we note that it is not necessary to postulate the existence of mountains as high as Mount Everest at the time of the flood, and thus to require waters covering the earth to a depth of 6 miles, as some proponents of a local flood suggest would be necessary. The antediluvian mountains, the pre-flood mountains, were very possibly much lower than at present. Passages in the book of Job and Psalms may well be referring to the process of post-diluvian or after-flood mountain uplift. See Job 9, chapter 9, verse 5, chapter 28, verse 9, and Psalm 104, verse 7 and 8. Also in this connection, we may address the objection that proponents of a local flood often raise, namely, that a worldwide flood would imply that the Earth's surface was completely renovated during the flood year, and thus pre-diluvian or before-flood topography would have been exceedingly different from post-diluvian topography. This implication, they claim, is in conflict with biblical evidence, which strongly suggests that pre-diluvian geography did basically resemble post-diluvian geography. References made particularly to the topographical descriptions in connection with the Garden of Eden, the lands of Havilah and Cush, and the four rivers, two of which, the Tigris and the Euphrates, were similar to the readers of Genesis in Moses' time. What is not recognized in these arguments, however, is that although there are some similarities between the pre-diluvian and post-diluvian topography, there are more differences than similarities. Two of the rivers mentioned apparently no longer existed in Moses' time. The Pison and the Gihon are mentioned in terms of where they used to flow in the post-diluvian areas of Havilah and Cush, respectively. The other two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, are described as coming from a common source in the Garden of Eden, certainly far different from their present courses. Thus, the topographical descriptions in the early chapters of Genesis are in harmony with a worldwide flood. Also, it is likely that survivors of the flood would use similar names for topographical features after the flood, even though the earth's surface looked entirely different. It's very interesting about the upheaval of mountains would really tie in with the, if you watch the lifespan of man, as it gradually, it rather quickly goes down to 100 years here in a matter of a few generations, where it used to be 1,000 years. So this is indicating that the earth is going through a process, a very quick process, but it's not an immediate process. Like the draining of the waters, the receding of the waters, it would indicate that perhaps more and more and more of the waters are being taken off. The oxygen level of the atmosphere is getting less and less and less, rather than just an immediate change. So you're going from this greenhouse, which they find a massive amount of coal, which is nothing but plant life that's hardened underneath Antarctica. So you're talking about Antarctica or the Arctic. You know, these poles now used to be a lush landscape. So, you know, the evidence that this was a greenhouse is pretty overwhelming. Now, you've got the upheaval of these mountains. Now, if the water is being drawn back into the earth, where's the dirt going to go? It's going to go up. So, that makes pretty good sense to me. Ninth, the duration of the flood makes sense only with a universal flood. The deluge of rain from above, the duration of the flood. We're talking about the length of time. The deluge of rain from above and water from the fountains of the deep below continued for 40 days, and all the highest mountains were still covered 5 months after the flood began. The tops of the mountains were not seen until after 7 months, and the floodwaters were not dried up enough for Noah to leave the ark until 1 year and 10 days had passed. Such lengths of time seem commensurate only with a universal and not a local flood. That makes perfect sense to me as well. If it was a local flood, you're talking about a massive flow of water rather than having a floating vessel. This is ridiculous. It's almost redundant at this point. You know, and you've got a year worth of time, over a year, that these guys are floating in this ark because there's not enough, you know, land out there for them to get down on. It is not going to take a year for a local flood to dry off. You know, even if it was confined in a basin of some type, you'd think. Okay, number 10. Tenth, the receding activity of the water is described by Hebrew phrases, which in parallel with similar phraseology are grammatical construction for the, quote, to and fro motion of the raven, should be translated as going and retreating, and imply oscillatory water motion lasting for 74 days. This is an ocean type of to and fro water, meaning going and retreating. This is a tide. The water's rushing back and forth like in ocean tidal movement, as the overall level gradually decreased, supports a universal interpretation such as, quote, the oceanic energy impulse model of the flood, but is incongruous with a local flood theory. I mean, there's nothing local about this terminology. And this is Hebrew we're talking about. 11th, the New Testament passages. Now we're talking about New Testament. We're out of the Old Testament. New Testament passages concerning the flood all employ universal language. Quote, swept them all away. Matthew 24, verse 39. Quote, destroyed them all. Luke 17, verse 27. Quote, he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah with seven other persons when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Quote, a few, that is eight persons, were saved through water. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 20. Noah, quote, condemned the world in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7. A local flood would not have ended the antediluvian world, meaning the pre-flood world. As Archer states, we have the unequivocal corroboration of the New Testament that the destruction of the human race at the time of the flood was total and universal. This is Archer, 1985. Number 12. The New Testament flood typology assumes and depends upon not only the historicity, but also the universality of the flood to theologically argue for an imminent worldwide judgment by fire. 2 Peter chapter 3, 6 and 7. Peter argues that just as there was a worldwide judgment by water causing the unbelieving antediluvian world to perish, so in the antitype, there must needs be a universal end-time judgment by fire, bringing about the destruction of the ungodly. And if any of you have any questions about Peter, who is the rock, the foundation of the church, take a look at 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 6 and 7. The New Testament flood typology assumes and depends upon not only the historical fact, but also the universal fact of the flood to theologically argue for the imminent worldwide judgment by fire that Peter talks about. And he says, just as the pre-flood world was judged by water, so there needs to be a judgment by fire on the earth. Now, this isn't going to be a local thing either. This is the way God works. We need to look at the personality of God, not our own personalities. You know, we need to not lean upon our own understanding. We got to lean upon God's understanding. If you were God, what would you have done? A local flood when the whole world is wicked? No. I personally wouldn't have done that. This is what I'm saying. I understand the guy. You know, we're created in his image. We receive his spirit and we're his sons. You should have a little understanding if you receive his spirit. 13th, key terms and motifs that we have already noted in Genesis 6 through 9 converge to make a major theological statement. The Noahic flood is nothing less than the cosmic undoing or reversal of creation. I love this. The reversal of creation. This is where he separates the waters from the waters, and what does he do? He brings them back together again and starts all over again with Noah. This is the context. Naam Sarna writes that, quote, "The flood is a cosmic catastrophe that is actually the undoing of creation. In other words, creation is being undone and the world returned to chaos." Also, another gent here describes the flood as the original cosmic undoing of creation. Another gentleman speaks of the invasion of chaos into the created order. The flood assumed cosmic proportions. Umberto, another gentleman, points out that the high point of the flood, we see water everywhere as though the world had reverted to its primeval state at the dawn of creation, when the waters of the deep submerged everything. Another gent uses the apt term bulversement, or reversal of creation, to depict the theological significance of the flood. Another gent, the deluge is an act of uncreation, undoing the work of separation by returning everything to the primeval watery chaos from which the created order first arose. Another gent here, we must understand the flood, therefore, as a catastrophe, including the entire cosmos. When the heavenly ocean breaks forth upon the earth below, this is the waters from above, and the primeval sea beneath the earth, which is restrained by God, we talked about that previously, now freed from its bonds, gushes up through the yawning chasms onto the earth. This is opening chasms, yawning chasms onto the earth. Then there is a destruction of the entire cosmic system according to biblical cosmology. The two halves of the chaotic primeval sea, two halves of the sea, one above, one below, separated, the one up, the other below, by God's creative government. This is chapter 1, verse 7 through 9, are again united. Creation begins to sink into chaos. Here the catastrophe, therefore, concerns not only men and beasts, but the earth, indeed the entire cosmos. So, this makes perfect sense to me. And what else is very interesting is one gent previously had called in on the line and had an argument about the flora, about the plant life, and you mean to tell me that it could be submerged for, you know, X amount of time? You can take an olive tree and keep it submerged for X amount of time, and it would not grow, etc. There are scientific requirements in order for plant life to grow. You got to have the same thing basically that we do: water, sun, and you got to have oxygen, and let's see, earth, wind, water, and fire. Okay. You got to have these four elements: earth, wind, water, and fire, and the fifth element, which would be God. Okay, so God is love. Some people call the fifth element love, but this, you know, is entirely up to God. Remember, He's God. He did all this. What makes you think that He couldn't grow some grass, or He couldn't grow an olive tree once you dried up the planet? You know, scientifically, God is bending the rules time and time again. You know, time and time again, but that's man's knowledge. We're looking at man's way of viewing things. You know, we got to understand that God is above and beyond that. This is the man who created science. Okay, this is the God who created science. So, you know, he can uncreate everything. He bends the rules. All right. So let's not put that beyond him. 14th and last, the cosmic reversal of creation is followed by a cosmic new beginning, as Klein states. The uncreation which God has worked with the flood is not final. Creation has not been permanently undone. Old unities of the natural world are restored, and the old ordinances of creation are renewed. This is what I'm talking about. Don't put it beyond God. If he can, on such and such a day, you've got this mass of water, and the next day he decides to make land appear. And, I mean, literally, if that's when land appeared, he's got that prerogative, whether it was under the water or not, you know. And also the plant life, you know, all these seeds and everything. He created these things. So if this is an uncreation, then certainly he has the prerogative to recreate plant life if he feels like it. You know, he did it once. And if this is an uncreation, he's starting from ground zero. What makes you think that he wouldn't do it again? You know, it's a pretty good probability. So we just got to at least give him that, so that it is a probability. Thus, in the overarching literary structure of the recreation in the flood narrative, the universal dimension of the flood is underscored by detailed parallels with the cosmic creation account of Genesis 1 and 2. So, I mean, there's so many parallels here that it would indicate this is an entire recreation. Okay? The conclusion. In conclusion, the question of the extent of the Genesis flood is not just a matter of idle curiosity with little at stake for the Christian faith. For those who see the days of creation in Genesis 1 as six literal 24-hour days, a universal flood is an absolute necessity to explain the existence of the geologic column. This is the time scale. A literal creation week is inextricably linked with a worldwide flood. But a universal flood is crucial not only in seeking to reconcile science and scripture, it is also pivotal in understanding and remaining faithful to the theology of Genesis 1 through 11 and the rest of Scripture. The many links with the universal creation in Genesis 1 and 2, which we've noted in this study, not only support the aspect of universality in the flood, but serve to theologically connect protology, that being creation, and eschatology, or judgment and salvation, in the opening chapters of Scripture. The flood, in an eschatological step-by-step uncreation of the world and humanity, followed by a step-by-step recreation of the new world. Thus, the story of the flood, and this is theologically the most important fact, shows an eschatological world judgment. The world judgment of the flood hangs like an iron curtain between this world age and that of the first splendor of creation. The theology of the universal flood is therefore the pivot of a connected but multifaceted universal theme running through Genesis 1 through 11 and constituting an overarching pattern for the entire subsequent worldwide creation, revealing the character of the Creator and His original purpose for creation. Humankind's turning from the Creator and the universal spread of sin ending in the universal, quote, uncreation through this judgment and recreation in the salvation of the faithful covenant remnant and the universal renewal of the earth. Very, very interesting article. I enjoy looking into articles of people that have letters behind their name, you know, like PhD and MD and stuff like this. At least these guys have done a lot of the work. You know, I love the internet. You can get on there, and these guys have spent all their money, and they've spent all their time doing all this research, and they wrap it up for you in about 8 to 10 pages, and you can get it all. So and it doesn't really cost you much more than a few dimes a day. It's beautiful. Beautiful. Information is wonderful. Another thing I wanted to point out about the change in the atmosphere after the global flood was the lack of oxygen that they're accrediting the short span of a man's life to the lack of oxygen after the greenhouse Earth was now gone. You've got the fruit and vegetables and everything starting to rot much earlier. So we're not getting the nutrition we need. We're not getting the oxygen that we need, and we're not living so long. So we're down to about 120 years. God says, it's going down 120 years, pal. And so we've gone from man, certainly in that day you shall die, God referring to 1,000 years, because people were living anywhere close to 1,000 years. Now man is down to 120. The amazing thing is, if you look in the scriptures under drunkenness, the first man to get drunk was Noah. The first man to get drunk recorded in the scriptures was Noah. Now, before Noah, all the stuff that happened, all the things from Adam to Noah, you won't find any scriptures referring to getting drunk. And so why does the scriptures mention that Noah's getting drunk? He had a vineyard. It says he planted a vineyard. So lo and behold, guess what? Noah was helping God in the replanting of the seeds. And seeds are really, really small. And considering the immense size of the ark, he very well could have had a whole lot of seeds, too. And all he really needed was a few of each kind. So here Noah plants a vineyard. Where did he get the seeds? Probably from his pocket. Okay, Noah drinks of the wine and gets drunk. Now, lo and behold, here's the first recording of a man getting drunk. Why? Because the atmosphere was different. You've got fermentation now. You don't just have grape juice. You got fermentation. So here he gets drunk. He's never been drunk before. He passes out in his tent. He lays there, and his skirt comes up over his hips. And lo and behold, one of his sons goes in and sees his father's nakedness, which is a wrong thing to do, and goes and tells his brother, and he was probably taunting. His other brothers took care of the situation. So the one kid was cursed. Now this curse, being on this one particular individual, okay, was why? Because of a spiritual problem, a problem that existed within that man. This wasn't because he was a different race or anything else like that. And all his descendants are all these Vites and Ites and all these other kind of things. So you've got these cursed descendants because of this spiritual seed, the spiritual act. You know, why else would God choose the tribe of Judah as being the eldest when he had three big brothers? Because they had spiritual problems. They were the same blood. You know, the same blood. But it was a spiritual issue. You know, and so he moves along according to the spiritual problem. Remember, it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out. Okay, this is a spiritual thing. Even Paul was bit by a snake. Okay, this snake was so deadly that just the fact that he stayed alive, people were thinking he was a god. Okay, it's not poison that went into his body that defiled him. It was the man that was coming out. It was the spirit. So God is in spirit, and he needs to be worshipped in spirit and in truth. So we're looking at the source of some of these curses that came down. And another indication that's not actually mentioned here of proof of the change in the atmosphere after the flood, because Noah gets drunk. You've got fermentation now. You've got a lack of oxygen. You've got grapes going sour. You know, I can go to the grocery store now and when I buy the grapes, they're sour. You know, it's hard to find decent grapes nowadays. Okay, let's take a look. I think it was in Matthew chapter 24. We were looking at Matthew chapter 24 a little bit ago. Let's take a look. If you're with us this morning, we've just discussed the biblical evidences, the strong biblical, in fact, I'm going to use the term absolute biblical evidences of the flood not being a local flood, but a global flood, and all mankind coming and being the descendants of Noah. Here in Matthew 24, verse 36 through 44, this is going to be very interesting. Okay, but of that day, Now, these are the words of Red. These are the words of Christ here. Okay, Matthew 24, verse 36. But of that day and hour knoweth no man. No, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched, and would not have suffered or allowed his house to be broken up. Therefore, be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. That is one of the supporting things also that Christ talks about Noah entering into the ark and correlating it, relating it to the end times when he comes. You know, it's whoever's going to get saved. This is another one of the passages of scripture that the rapture crowd likes to utilize. And we're going to be taking a look at the pros and cons of the rapture next week, and we're going to take a look and see what both sides have to say about that, and we'll be also taking calls as well. Calls are also always very welcome here at the studio, and we're pretty well wrapped up with this topic. Again, the topic was the biblical evidences of the universality of Noah's flood, the worldwide cataclysm, the deluge, that it was in fact worldwide, not local. And last week we looked at the geological evidences, some of the geological evidences. We scratched the surface and covered two of the geological evidences. And today we've discussed eight different Hebrew terminologies that indicate the universality of the flood, and 14 other points that would indicate the universality of the flood. So if anybody wants to call in to the station, I guess it's a little early, but we can go ahead and do that. The number here is 702-293-5224. Again, the number is 702-293-5224. If anybody has any comments about the veracity of the topic, about the factual evidence of the topic, or any creation studies that they were actually not mentioned today that they can contribute to this, or if anybody has any opposing discussion, please feel free to call in. But let's use some actual scientific evidence and stuff when it comes to this. We're talking about not just theological debates here between you and I, but we're talking about the evidence that men with letters behind their names have spent a lot of time finding. We have a caller on line one. Let's see who we have here. You're on the air from the hip. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
I don't want to be on the air. I want just to talk to somebody there.
Oh, okay. Well, call back in just a second.
Okay.
Oh, he can pick you up? Okay. Well, my mistake. Okay, if anybody wants to call in and have their give us the pros and cons of any kind of evidence that they might want to come up with, bring it to the table and we can discuss this. Preferably, it'll be something besides your own theological debate, but we would like to have some well-researched topics here. So any callers are welcome. In the meantime, I think while we're waiting for a caller, we'll go ahead and take another break and listen to some more of this good news blues. Let's see, what have we not heard today? How about this? Jesus is the Rock. Yeah? All right, man. Refreshing. Welcome back, brothers and sisters. You're here listening to Remnant Radio, shows from the hip. My name is JT, and we're inviting callers. And the number here is 702-293-5224. The topic for today is the biblical evidence of the universality of the Genesis flood account, the Noahic flood, the deluge, and what the Bible has to say in anything from the Old Testament to the New Testament. We've discussed eight different Hebrew terms and how the terminology actually proves that the flood was global, and 14 other points that have also proven all the different things that allude to a global evidence of the flood. Last week we discussed the geological evidences of the flood, and at least we scratched the surface. Only two of the hundreds of geological proofs, one of them being sand and the other one being coal, and how these prove that there was in fact a gigantic, violent upheaval of underground water that washed plant life and broke large trees violently. And there's no evidence of anything else besides. There's no root evidence where this coal is found. There's no root structure. It's clay underneath, and the plant life is actually coming from a very high altitude. Let's take a look again at the eight terminologies that the Hebrews used in order to refer to the deluge being universal or entirely global. The first term, Ha'arez, meaning the earth, was used 46 times in the flood narrative and without any accompanying limitation. And it parallels the usage of the same term in the universal creation in the Genesis account, chapter 1, verses 1, 2, and 10. And so the only time that you have a different word is the Hebrew term tebel, which is only used in the poetic references to the globe, as it would be a Hebrewism or something that would rhyme with something else. But it is never written by Moses, the writer of the Pentateuch, that that the earth and the terminology that was used means anything besides the entire globe. Second term was Alpene Kol Ha'aretz, which means upon the face of all the earth. And this alludes to the first occurrence of the same phrase, actually, was used in the universal context of creation in Genesis 1, verse 29. Remember, Moses is the writer of all these books. So we have to look at the pen of Moses. And he is not just writing these things as the Holy Spirit is showing these things. He's using his own language, or the language of God. You know, he's using, but he's the pen man here. So obviously he understands, you know, that when he's referring to, or if God through him is referring to the creation of the earth in a global context, and he's using the same terminology that that would indicate that there was a recreation of the earth in a global context, again, during the flood. So we have the same man writing in the same book, only a few chapters later. Okay, let's keep that in mind. You're not going to get a different, you know, relation in the words from one chapter to the next when the same man's writing it under the God-breathed, inspired by the same God. Now, third, the phrase "face of the ground" is "pene ha'adama," or this is "face of the ground." It occurs in parallel with universal terms, just as we've noted, being the earth and the face of all the earth. And the phrase "face of the ground," likewise, it harks back to its first usage in the universal context of creation in Genesis chapter 2, verse 6. The fourth term was "kol basar," or "all flesh," occurs 12 times in Genesis. And the word "kol," which occasionally expresses less than total, less than all. It is the word "all," but it occasionally expresses less than total, depending on the context. But in all of the 12 times in Genesis 6 through 9, the word never, it doesn't have before, it is not before an intermediate noun with no article or possessive suffix. And here in Genesis 6 through 9, it indicates totality. So the word, you know, before indeterminate noun with no article or possessive suffix would indicate totality. So God's announcement to destroy all flesh, and the narrator's comment, "all flesh died," except the inhabitants of the ark, would indicate totality as well as unity. The only one time when kol is used, all the flesh, rather than all flesh, means not only totality, but the unity of all the flesh. So, fifth, the expression every living thing being kol ha-he, or of all flesh, is another expression of totality. So there's hardly one man that we quoted here a few times, Hassel is his name, says there's hardly any stronger way in Hebrew to emphasize total destruction of all existence of human and animal life on earth than the way it has been expressed. So there's an amazing amount of support here, just, you know, in these grammatic ways that prove throughout the Bible, not just in the Old Testament and in the text of the flood itself, but all the way through the New Testament, you're getting all these evidences that everybody knew what they were talking about. They spoke Hebrew, you know, they knew what the language meant. So let's take a look, and not only that, we got to refer to the actual character of God and look at what he's done and how he does things. It says God never changes, you know. So we got to take a look at when he's sorry about man, he's gonna recreate man. The writer of the Genesis flood story employed terminology, formula, and syntactical structures of the type that could not be more emphatic and explicit in expressing his concept of a universal worldwide flood. Sixth, the phrase under the whole heaven, Tahat Kol Hasamayim, is used six times in the Old Testament outside of the flood narrative, and always with a universal meaning. So every time it says under the whole heaven throughout the Bible, it always means the entire earth. So the universal phrase under the whole heaven, or under all the heavens, universalizes the phrase under heaven in Genesis 6:17 in the same flood context. The word heaven alone can have a local meaning, but here the context is clearly universal. So, look at the seventh term. Is another term that Hassel devoted an entire article to the phrase, all the fountains, Ma Yenoth, of the great deep, Tehom Rava. And he showed how it's linked with the universal deep, Tehom, or world ocean, in Genesis 1, verse 2. Psalms 104, verse 6 says, Thou didst cover it, being the earth, with deep, Tehom, as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. And it goes on into the breaking up, as this psalm says, and busting forth of all the fountains of the deep, could not possibly be just a localized flood in Mesopotamia. Eighth, we're looking at another Hebrew term, Mabul, which is a special term, and its 13 occurrences refers exclusively to the universal Genesis flood, the 12 occurrences in Genesis and once in Psalm 29, verse 10. The word derived from the Hebrew word yabul, or to flow, to stream. The term Mabul, which is the flood narrative, in the flood narrative, is associated with Mayim, or waters, has seems to become a technical term for waters flowing or streaming forth, and as such designates the flood being caused by waters. So the Genesis flood narrative provides ample evidence of being an account which is to be understood as a historical narrative in prose style. It expects to be taken literally. There is a consistent and overwhelming amount of terminological and terminology and formula, which, on the basis of context and syntax, has uniformly indicated that the flood story wants to be understood in a universal sense. The waters destroyed all human and animal, plus bird life, on the entire landmass of the globe. To read it otherwise means to force a meaning which the text itself rejects. On carefully written and specific syntactical constructions of the original language. So those are the eight terms that of Hebrew that prove that the flood was in fact a global flood. Let's do a summary of the 14 points that we discussed after that. 14 points, the trajectory of the major themes in Genesis 1 through 11, the creation, the fall, the plan of redemption, and the spread of sin, is universal in scope and calls for a corresponding universal judgment, that being the flood. Specific flood terminology allude to, and numerous times allude to, universal context of creation. We're using the same terminology for a recreation as we did for the original creation. Likewise, the fall of humanity and the plan of redemption is universal in scope. That being, God saw the wickedness of man, Hadam, or humankind. Second point, the divine purpose given for the bringing of the flood makes explicit its universal scope. The destruction of humanity would necessitate more than a local flood. The third point, the genealogical lines for both Adam and Noah are exclusive in nature, indicating that as Adam was father to all pre-flood humanity, so Noah was father of all post-flood humanity. Point number four, the same inclusive divine blessing to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth is given to both Adam and Noah. The point number five, the covenant with its rainbow sign is linked to the extent of the flood, meaning the whole earth. If there was only a local flood, then the covenant would be a limited covenant, and the rainbow sign of the all-embracing universality of the divine mercy would be stripped of its meaning. Sixth, the viability of God's promise and the integrity of God in keeping his promise is wrapped up in the worldwide extent of the flood. If Genesis 6 through 9 describes only a local flood, then God has broken his promise every time another local flood has happened. Point number 7. We do have a caller. Are we on? Line 1. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Brave Feather.
Hey, Brave Feather. We're just wrapping up the show here, and I'm going over the 14 points that were given. And what kind of program do you have for us today?
Oh, I was going to bring a kind of a out of left field Christmas message.
Oh, out of left field Christmas. That's nice and refreshing. Cool. Well, we got it. We got a few minutes, so just hang on the line, and we'll be right with you.
Do what you got to do.
Okay, we're covering. Right, we're down here on the 7th. The universality of the flood is underscored by enormous size of the ark, and the filled with all the different non-aquatic animal and plant kinds would not be necessary if this was a local flood. There was no other escape. Okay, otherwise God would have told him just get out of the area. This is what he's done in the past, and you know, I guess from this point of view it would have been the future. But eighth, the covering of all high mountains by at least 15 cubits couldn't possibly have been a local flood because of the science of water finding its own level. The ninth point is the duration of the flood makes sense only with a universal flood. The deluge from above and the fountains of the deep continued for 40 days, and the mountains were not even seen until after 7 months. The flood waters weren't dried up enough for Noah to leave the ark until a year and 10 days had passed. So this couldn't be anything besides a universal flood. Tenth, the receding activity of the water is described by Hebrew phrases, which is parallel with similar phraseology and grammatical construction for the to and fro motion of the raven. And it should be translated as going and retreating. And this would be waters rushing back and forth like an ocean tidal movement. This is not a local flood. The 11th point, the New Testament passages concerning the flood all employ universal language, like swept them all away, destroyed them all. He did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah with 7 other persons. Few, that is 8 persons, were saved through water. Noah condemned the world. The local flood would not have ended the world. The 12th point, the New Testament flood typology assumes and depends upon not only the history, but also the universal flood to theologically argue for an imminent worldwide judgment by fire. This is the one that I really like. 2 Peter 3, verses 6 through 7. Peter argues that just as there was a worldwide judgment by water causing the unbelieving antediluvian world to perish, so in the antitype there must needs be a universal end-time judgment by fire, bringing forth the destruction of the ungodly. The 13th point, a key term and motifs that we've already noted in Genesis 6 through 9, converge to make a major theological statement. The Noahic flood is nothing less than the undoing or reversal of creation. This is where the waters again meet. God separates the waters from above, from the waters below. He holds the waters from below. He releases these waters from below, and it all comes together again. And you've got the earth back to square one. We must understand the flood, therefore, as a catastrophe involving the entire cosmos. When the heavenly ocean breaks forth upon the earth below and the primeval sea beneath the earth, which is restrained by God, now freed from its bonds, gushes up through the yawning chasms onto the earth, then there is a destruction of the entire cosmic system according to biblical cosmology. Two halves of the chaotic primeval sea, separated, the one up, the other below, by God's creative government, are again united. Creation begins to sink into chaos. Here, this is a rebirth of the earth. The 14th and the last point, the cosmic reversal of creation is followed by a new beginning. The uncreation which God has worked with the flood is not final. Creation has not been permanently undone. Old unities of the natural world are restored, and the old ordinances of creation are renewed. So this has been a discussion of the biblical evidences as opposed to the geological evidences discussed last week. This is becoming disgusting to me, to be quite honest with you. That was a Freudian slip. But this is overwhelming. So how anybody can take any of the biblical evidence written by men with letters after their name and also the geological evidence, which there is actually hundreds of evidences of a flood. And in fact, Brave Feather has discussed this as well on some of his show. The evidence is overwhelming, and God wants us to look at evidence. He wants us to see hard evidence. We don't do this burning in the bosom stuff like the Mormons want you to believe in the Book of Mormon by a burning in the bosom, and there's not a single shred of evidence to the whole book geologically anywhere. You know, they can't even find one spearhead, you know, from these people or any kind of papyrus or you name it. We've got evidence in the Bible that goes even further back than the 2,500 years that the Mormons go. So the thing that God wants us to do is put Him to the test, put His Word to the test, and if it's got good fruit, then it's true. And if it's got bad fruit, then brother, don't eat it. Okay? And with that, we're going to wrap it up. My name is JT. This is From the Hip, and we're going to continue today. I'm going to be your sidekick, Brother Brave Feather, because our brother has got other things he's got to do. Pilgrim's got a few things he's going to take care of, and we're going to run with your program straight into that. And you're listening to Maintenance and Repair with Brave Feather and his sidekick for this week, JT. And the number here at the studio, which is Remnant Radio, is 702-293-5224. Brave Feather, what do you got for us today?
Well, I was going to... It was a sermon that I gave this week at the mission. And I think we can break it down into kind of a forum. And hopefully we'll get some callers in, either with agree or disagree.
I'm sure we will.
But that'd be great if we could. But this show, for anybody that's just tuning in, has never heard